Okay, we're recording now. I'm Larry Johnson. This is Sonar 21. And with me again is my good old friend, or old good friend, Larry Cunningham. Larry's retired as a Secret Service agent, served both doing protective details, served in the training division, knows what he's talking about. So we're going to discuss today the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, because frankly, a lot of the explanations that are out there stink. Larry, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. Good morning. I've actually had a number of podcast interviews, and I pondered this. I'm actually preparing an op-ed regarding this. At the front end, I would like to say that my goal in life here is to clear the air, set the record straight. Inevitably, when these things occur, we have hundreds of experts, quote unquote, coming out of the woodwork, and that's fine, but this is America. But on the other hand, there are a lot of things that take traction that frankly are incorrect, or the basis of them are incorrect. So I'd like to offer a couple things from my vantage point, just to make sure we're all on the same sheet of music for our audience here. I have 50 years plus experience in this arena. Older guy, still learning, but I do have some sense of operational procedures, training, and policy that are directly spoken about and inputted into this assassination attempt. I was involved in my earlier career in the Secret Service with basic protection training, field work, and then I investigated lots of threats. The thrust of my work in the service was in our training division, where we did seminal programs and policy to address evolving threats, and most importantly, to address the capability of agents assigned to a detail, whether it's a foreign dignitary, a candidate detail, a president, or head of state. How do we respond? What are the protocols, and how can we improve them? Obviously, that takes a lot of training, intense training, consistent training, which we did not see in the group that was protecting former President Ford. Some of these things notably involve attack on the principal exercises. They involve in the field extraction exercises, real life scenarios in the actual environments where protectees would typically visit, and also stage ones that would reflect typical rallies, stage areas, convention halls, picnic areas, motorcade routes, you name it. So that's the kind of background that I have. I did that for about 5 years. Then I was assigned to the Presidential Protective Division with President Reagan, where we did similar things. And I actually practiced those in real time. I was involved in being an advisor for agents that were assigned advances. I did many, many myself. I did kind of a tally the other day, and it's about 200. I've done them for sites. I've done them for major events and as a site person and as a lead person, which meant that I had responsibility for all the facets of those aspects of the preparation for those venues. So after that, then I was assigned to our office in San Jose, California, where we had a plethora of protective visits. Being the Silicon Valley, you can imagine we had heads of state, we had candidates, we had presidents, all that stuff. So those kinds of things are my experience level. Since I retired, I've done many other related initiatives, including training probably about 10,000 police officers, a significant number of which were in New York and other parts of the country and the world. So my experience is diverse, and it's comprehensive. And when I speak about these things, I'm speaking from a perspective that I want to set the record straight, but as importantly, I want to foster improvement. So that's the baseline, what we're starting from. So Larry, where would you like me to begin in terms of looking at this particular unfortunate, egregious assassination attempt?
Okay, so we both agree that the initial explanations about this just stink. And as we assess it, it looks like the ultimate breakdown came with the woman that was put in charge of doing the advanced work and running the scene that day. Is that a fair assessment, or is that inaccurate?
Oh, that's correct. And I think for the group here, I'd like to go over some of the breakdown, how that advanced team, quote unquote, is formulated. On paper, it's important for everybody to note, and we haven't seen much about this, but there is a very specific statute that governs and defines what the Secret Service is supposed to do. It covers investigative and protective duties. It's title, for those who want to look it up, it's United States Code, Title 18, 3056. Of note, and applicable to this particular assassination attempt, is Title 18, 3056, parenthesis A, parenthesis 7. The reason I bring that out is it very specifically details the kinds of authority and resources, et cetera, that are to be applied to a candidate for president or vice president. It also has an area there on the third entry, the third criteria, that talks about how vitally important it is to make sure that commensurate resources are applied for extraneous circumstances. An example would be Robert Kennedy. He certainly fits the criteria. He was denied, by the way, for a variety of reasons. It's hard to speculate on. It hasn't been come out publicly, but candidly, the suspicion is that he posed a threat to draw votes away from the incumbent. At any rate, he certainly fit the criteria because his brother and uncle were assassinated. He asked for it and was not granted that. Now let's look to former President Trump. His threat level was extreme, beyond any that I've seen in my history and what I've studied, certainly more than Biden, certainly more than, candidly, Robert Kennedy or any other. And these kinds of threats that he had were very direct, and you've seen them. They've been all over the media. In fact, the incumbent actually referenced putting a target on this individual.
Yeah,
For others that have been prominently displayed in the media that out and out said that a bullet should be put in his head. This kind of thing is very, very dangerous rhetoric because it sort of inspires paranoid schizophrenics and so forth. So the reason I bring that up is because now that we're looking at this more in depth, based on the results of two congressional interviews now with the former director, Cheadle, and the current acting director, Roe, the answers they're giving, and couple that with the information that the Grassley, Senator Grassley, is uncovering with whistleblowers, it's revealing some exceedingly disturbing, I'll say it again, information that basically looks like there is a disparate attention, a disparate allocation of resources and so forth. To get back to Larry's question about the agent assigned to this detail, normally a major presidential or vice presidential candidate is afforded a complement of agents that almost mirrors the president's. In this case, former President Trump had an excessive number of threats ongoing for at least 2 years. And just prior to Butler, there was a direct assassination plot uncovered from Iran. Now, what does that mean in this context? Well, what that means is because of that type of direct threat and heightened threat, candidly, in my experience, management would make arrangements to make sure that the best team that could be put together to address all the facets of an advanced preparation procedure would be placed. This was not done. This was not done in Butler. Candidly, there's whistleblower information that said that despite ongoing entreaties and pleas for more resources and more agents, et cetera, for former President Trump during the prior 2 years, prior to Butler and during the Butler, prior to the Butler advance, these entreaties, these requests were basically denied. Now, this has been substantively established. In fact, Acting Director Rowe's testimony acknowledged that, including the spokesperson for the Secret Service, who initially denied this and then they backtracked it. So now we have a disparate application of resources that aren't commensurate with the threat level for that protectee. This is egregious. There's nothing less than that. It's the ultimate negligence. So To answer the question, going back to this particular agent that was assigned from Pittsburgh, according to whistleblower information we have right now, I haven't been able to verify it beyond that, but I can tell you that the information states that this person did not have the requisite experience to be conducting an advance, apparently only 2 years or less. Well, when you couple that with the backdrop and the context of threat that I mentioned to you, this is another egregious situation. So we have someone that's not capable. Now, the other question is, well, what kinds of resources were the advance team given for Butler? Initially, a request was made through the candidate nominee operation section. And what they do is they typically give a schedule and say, former president is going to Butler, Pennsylvania. These are the resources that we need. And theoretically, they're supposed to be given a commensurate number of agents and so forth. Typically, the inner perimeter, those agents you saw that responded to that threat did quite well. That is the detail. That is the inner perimeter detail. There's a shift leader and a shift leader and a detail leader that make those calls to move whatever the case may be. They direct that inner perimeter. Now, in the outer perimeter, on paper, you're supposed to have a complement of Secret Service field agents to handle access egress, other posts of importance as you get to the middle perimeter. The right. Outer perimeter typically will be police officers in the jurisdiction or a combination thereof. Well, turns out that only one Secret Service type, according to whistleblowers, was designated and assigned to that middle perimeter. And the outer perimeter had police. The rest of that middle perimeter was comprised of Homeland Security agents. Nothing wrong with that in terms of having folks that have the authority to assist. However, there's a lot wrong with it if you think about what is their training.
That's right. They're not trained to do personal protection.
No, and that was painfully obvious when you saw the response of the shift to cover and evacuate former President Trump. So these are the holes. Now, that's the basic structure. Now, if you like, I'll get into how this is supposed to transpire, and then we can talk about failings.
But yeah, let me first just make the point,
please,
that just because she's a woman doesn't mean a woman's not capable of doing this. The point is, she was not selected for this job because she had the experience. She was selected for it because she was a woman. That's the point.
Absolutely.
They were using DEI as a criteria to say, this will look good for her, maybe.
Yeah.
But
and that's a failing of allowing ideology to enter in operational decisions, and it's tragic. I've actually, as a note here, I've put together many big security plans. I've been involved in many, for example, namely the World War II Memorial. It's been a while back, but the person in charge of that was a Park Police representative, and she, a female, and she was very capable, kept meetings on task, was very good about delegating and so forth. So absolutely, I don't care who you are. If you're capable, competent, having the experience, I'm all in. When you're not, I'm concerned. That's
okay. And so let's talk about, what is the standard for doing advance in a place like Butler?
Okay, the standard would be the following. The schedule comes out, an advance agent is assigned. That advance agent is supposed to go to the site and meet with the event planner, the chief of police, also any other chiefs, sheriff, SWAT members, and so forth that would comprise the team. Ideally, this initial meeting should basically include all players. And basically, the general concerns are aired at that point. Critically, as an advance agent, I've done hundreds of these. What you would do is you would pair up appropriate folks from the advance team with the folks from law enforcement. Meaning, what does that mean? Well, you would have a site person. You have the site agent, but you have a lieutenant or captain type that would accompany that lead person and go through the site and look at vulnerabilities. After all, Butler is their house, not our house.
Yeah.
You can't do this by yourself. Apparently, these meetings never occurred on good authority by representatives from SWAT and the police department and Butler County Commissioner Office. So that's a problem. Also, it's important to note that when you have these meetings, you hook up an agent with a counterpart that is responsible for responses, intelligence, issues that occur, much like the issue with state police seeing the shooter at one of the mag points as early as an hour before the shooting yeah. with a rangefinder. That kind of issue, suspicious activity, would be investigated by a person from the police department and our Secret Service component with intelligence function, the role to find out what the heck this is. Also, in recent history, they've been adding a counter sniper unit, which kind of works in the background, and they look for things that are unusual or specifically for people watching with ill intent, watching the operation. And that was not there. A dog team was not there. A drone was denied. And candidly, all those things added up to a fiasco. On good testimony now, the police are saying in Butler that they were never invited to a meeting, and also that they were not asked or designated to put a person on that AGR roof. That's devastating. In fact, they were put inside of a building, which I don't understand how you could possibly be eyes yeah. and ears, be a proactive response. So these are basic things that were not pieces that were not part of this advanced team. Egregious. So when, and another issue, candidly, is there's a big question about how the command post was comprised and manned. There's a lot of discussion about communication. It seems to be the big Achilles heel here. Well, you talk about resources and things. Well, the acting director 2 days ago said in the congressional hearing that it would take about 8 weeks or so or months to configure and integrate local communications with encrypted Secret Service communications. I was aghast at that. I thought, my gosh. So because it takes 8 weeks, you can't communicate. The basic thing is, what happened to resourcefulness? How about your cell phone? How about if you have your command post staffed correctly? And I always did it this way. This is the way it should be done. In many other instances, you have a representative from EMT, sheriff, SWAT, and other public safety response entities
yeah.
in that command post.
Yeah, sitting right there.
In, yeah. Right. A picture of a suspicious person or an urgent message that comes in on the local radio, and then that can be passed immediately. That yeah. There's a big question about the staffing of that. It sounds like it was a tent and it wasn't staffed appropriately. So you have no meetings, you have no sheet of music, you don't have any same operating procedure. Now, CS, counter sniper, I read just yesterday on the reports from Grassley's whistleblowers that a day prior, no counter sniper team was designated. At the last minute, they did decide to send two teams out. Normally they send three. Well, they're already compromised now because of time. Obviously, they're stretched and they have to probably do some liaison with the local SWAT team. That's
well,
all
let me,
fine.
Let me ask yes, you a question please. On that front.
Yes.
Is mm-hmm. it the job? Is it the job of the lead on the counter sniper team to basically go up and stand at the podium where the principal will be, and then to do a 360 scan to identify where possible lines of fire?
Okay.
Is that the counter sniper unit's job, or is it someone else to do that?
Okay. You're getting in a couple pieces here. Just hold this. I'll go over the designation. On the motorcade route, there's what's called a counter assault team, and their job in life is to look for any vulnerabilities, any threats, and neutralize them as best as possible so the motorcade can proceed unscathed without delay. The counter assault team are the folks, the expert shooters that perch themselves in various vantage points on buildings. Now, the folks that you saw at the front of the stage were considered the counter assault team. Counter assault. The counter okay. snipers are on the buildings, and they okay. are usually in a stationary position. However, it appears that none of these entities were integrated properly with the detail itself, because they were kind of ad hoc, and the person managing it didn't bring them together. But also, it's becoming obvious now, based on input, emails, and texts from the SWAT and the local police that they never met with the counter sniper and the Secret Service counter snipers. So the other issues that come to mind is, well, what about rules of engagement? We have potential for friendly fire and more of a fiasco. The other question I have is, granted, you had very limited resources, but if that's the case, why didn't you conduct your normal advance where you would go from all the vantage points you think may pose a threat and physically put yourself on that and decide, hey, how can we deal with this? It's not that difficult to ask. And maybe if you're really short of manpower and time, why didn't you order a tarp or cut that branch down or post that building and ensure it was posted? Whenever I was involved in advances, both as a post-trainer early on, and then as a site person, then as a lead supervisor, I always met with the counter snipers at all these meetings. We had as many meetings as we could, at least once a day, sometimes twice a day. And each entity that I described earlier would present their findings, their presentations, strengths, weaknesses, and what was needed. So none of that was done. So there's a real lack of imagination, both from a communication perspective, but more egregiously, a sense of urgency. These things were in the context and the backdrop of all these terrible threats. Why in the world didn't a suspicious person become a very important priority in the command post? And apparently, both the former director, Cheadle, and the current acting director, Rowe, said that they tried to soften and sort of redefine what suspicious means. Well, in the context of all the threats we're talking about, you need to take action ASAP, particularly if you know that you're under-resourced, you don't have the correct manpower, and now you have a suspicious person whose picture is being sent about, and there's a sense of urgency among all concerned that saw them. The most egregious thing, yesterday it was determined that one of the one of the spectators who was seriously injured, but is going to make it, thank God. His photo, ironic as that is, his video and photos show Crooks not hunkered down with barely his forehead showing, as the acting director said, which was sort of quasi an excuse why they didn't catch this earlier. Well, actually, he is, by some descriptions, almost dancing on the roof. He's running down to his location.
Yeah.
The spectator took a video of this, which completely negated anything that acting director said. There was ample opportunity. We call that a clue in police work, not to be facetious.
Yeah.
If a spectator can see this, what in the world are the counter sniper and other folks doing? So
yeah,
these are egregious failings.
Well, that's the debriefing that needs to take place at some point, that these counter sniper, what did they see and when did they see it?
Exactly.
It's
interesting you bring that up, and I want to bring up one more point here. When surveys, advances that I've been participating in or leading, we would actually walk the site. If there was any question at all about a hole or a gate or a potential vulnerable area, we would physically walk it.
Yeah,
I mean, go out there. I mean, it's your responsibility. Find what the story is and take the folks with you. Take notes. That's called in the weeds, careful, detailed advances. The other thing that was conspicuously absent, and then you can continue here, Larry, but normally there is a second supervisor or a supervisor that comes in the day before to go over things. Four eyes are better than two.
Yeah.
Eight are better than two. And that purpose of that supervisor was to look at everything in total, complete situational awareness, totality of the circumstances, and the totality of the advanced resources, and say, this is what I see. What about this? That wasn't done. So bedrock, foundational, operational advanced procedures were either neglected or ignored. I mean, these are negligent omissions that speak to incredible incompetence. And some of the testimony that we saw by the supposed top people in the Secret Service exposed this profound ignorance of operational procedures and neglect.
Yeah.
And that's the only way I can describe it, looking at all the subjective material that I've studied in the past several days.
Now, so who was ultimately responsible for, using the podium? You go to the podium and you look, just, you do a 360 scan. Who's the one that looks at that and says, okay, this is where we need to put counter sniper teams. These are the areas that we need to be sure covered. Whose job is that?
Okay. Ultimately, the responsibility of that is the site agent, the lead site agent. All the pieces, whether it's an emergency route, hospitals, posts, counter sniper, whatever, that's all their responsibility ultimately. They may not have the specific expertise that a counter sniper has. However, it's incumbent upon all concerned and the lead to get a brief from the counter sniper team. This is what I have. And collectively, they're supposed to look at this and study it, which
Yeah.
we normally do, and say yes or no. That wasn't done. So you have so many holes. You have kind of ad hoc siloed elements of a security advance that really wasn't integrated properly, in my view.
Yeah. I mean that right there, I think, underscores what the problem was, that they did not have an integrated plan, and they allowed those gaps. Just even Roe. And I guess he's part of the problem. What is the criticisms of Cheadle, although fair, ignored the fact that the guy who had actual day-to-day responsibility for overseeing the decisions regarding protecting dignitaries, protecting candidates, was Roe.
Yeah,
And so a
exactly.
lot of these failures and problems were under his watch. I mean, and now they put him in charge.
It's unbelievable because it's painfully obvious to me and other agents I've talked to and other experts and just common sense that these kinds of omissions were basic. I mean, how could you not have a police meeting? How could you not overcome communications interoperability problems? How could you not post people in logical places? One of the more egregious things, and I'm going to give you three things I'm very concerned about as a result, is that when you talk about communications, none of this information about a suspicious person was relayed to the working shift, the detail leader, the shift leader. That's egregious. If you're familiar with anything about sports, take your favorite sport, soccer, football, baseball, whatever. I mean, how in the world can you, the quarterback and the coach have a private meeting, but not tell the receivers and not tell the blockers? So each of them had to figure out what was going to happen when it was an offensive play. I mean, this is nuts. Of course, you're going to lose the Super Bowl. Of course, you're going to lose a game. In this case, with a zero failure game, this is beyond comprehension. And candidly, it's just beyond comprehension. I'm talking about this from a 50-year perspective. And to have the director, former director, and the current acting director abdicate responsibility for these basic things that are inscribed in law that belong to the Secret Service, say, well, that was beyond our secure zone. That is nothing more than a sophomoric vacuous answer. There's no other way to describe it. Any threat that is presenting itself to our protectee needs to be addressed. And if you've arbitrarily set up a certain secure zone, that doesn't all of a sudden mean that anything beyond that won't hurt the protectee or is not your responsibility. Oh, contraire. I mean, that's just, and that is a very serious problem. Now, the reason I brought those two things up about the protectee and the police being candidly thrown under the bus, for lack of a better term, it does several things moving forward that it scares the hell out of me, frankly. Number one, we rely with the 3,500 complement of agents that do protection, we rely heavily on the local law enforcement. It's their house. They know the culture. They know what equipment they have. And it's incumbent upon a lead person, the Secret Service, to go into those environments and say, look, we're a team. This is your house. How can we best get the mission accomplished? That's how we always did it before. So obviously, they would tell you these things, whatever's needed. You would express, as a Secret Service agent, what your concerns are, and then you would make it work. Well, without meeting these people and then having something happen and then abdicating the responsibility to them is not only egregious, but it's also very difficult now for future relationships. Apparently, the president is going back to Butler either tomorrow or the next day. Well, what kind of advance agent is going to be assigned? Number one, what kind of experience? But number two, and most concerning, is how are you going to establish an honest, fair, trusting rapport with people that you've thrown under the bus? This is impossible. This is very, very difficult, because we're not talking about, gee, do we want to buy a Ford or a Chevy? No, we're talking about life and death. So it's not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of getting trust there. Second egregious problem is the rapport with the principal. For those of us that are married, in relationships, good friends, war buddies, police officers, anybody that's a team, you know that the basis of your relationship, if it's going to survive, is trust. Well, now we have a protectee that was not informed of a threat. Probably not the inner shift's fault, but they should have been given that information ongoing an hour earlier. And then updates, because it would have been very easy for that detail leader, based on the threat level, which he or she was acutely aware of, and also the history of not getting the right resources, that information I would offer would be carefully considered, and they would recommend, Mr. Trump, we are going to stay in the limo. We're going to stay in the holding room until this gets resolved. Well, you had Roe 2 days ago say that it wasn't trying to distinguish and dilute the idea of a suspicious person. We don't take those kinds of movements or actions unless it becomes a serious threat. Well, that's, I mean, it's beyond naive. I mean, that's about as vacuous as it gets in the context of everything I've described to you and everything that whistleblower is talking about and everything that the PD and the SWAT folks are indicating and testifying to at the moment. Lastly, another huge concern, and I think Radcliffe mentioned it as well, but in the context of the first two, this third one has me deeply concerned too. And what is that? That's the idea that our adversaries, the enemy states, the terrorists, and other would-be, wannabe assassins, wannabe idiots, for lack of a better term, are looking at this saying, wow, look at all the notoriety, but also look at the vulnerability. We can exploit this easily. And they had to, I'm sure some are looking at this twice and saying, gosh, this, you know, you talk about taking candy from a sleeping baby. This baby has had sleeping pills. I mean, we just walk in and do it. Other point now, which I think is very important. We all talk in the business, military folks know this very well. We talk about red teaming. We talk about putting the adversary's hat on and seeing how we can penetrate a area, a secure area, or a compromise, a secure plan. Well, here we have a 20-year-old, 21-year-old that has done the ultimate red team defeat. He looks at this, he sends in his own drone, which we apparently the Secret Service decided not to use it. They declined the request or the offer. And so we have this individual, the assassin, come to the site a couple of times, acting weird, and then he also bring his own drone in there and then looking at the site. He'd been there a day before earlier, and then he'd been a couple of times. And he's walking around, not acting like a normal spectator, normal fan of Trump. So what we have here is we have someone who is doing probing of the site, classic stuff. He's also looking at vulnerabilities, but also importantly, and the state police and other police assigned to that area picked up on right away, his behavior exceeded the baseline. His behavior was not normal. And because of that, in the context of the threats and also having a rangefinder, we call that a clue, and we call it more than a suspicious person. And if it turns out to be there's a one-off, great. But I want the one-off to be where we overreact and say, or react and say, look, we are going to stop everything now. We're going to get this resolved. We're going to find this person. We're going to be 20 minutes late, whatever, fine. That was not done. And to me, that's among the most egregious responses to a quote-unquote suspicious person. And to have the acting director dilute that value or dilute the urgency of quote-unquote that suspicious person is egregious, negligent.
So we've got so many failures of on the part of the Secret Service to follow standard operating procedures, default of the failure to do advance, failure to have communications in place, failure to secure an outer perimeter, failure to do the proper preparation and brief for a counter sniper team, failure to interact with the local authorities in a proper way to ensure their coordination. So with all these failures, was this deliberate sabotage on the part of senior Secret Service leadership? Or is this just a natural consequence of an agency that's decided to emphasize diversity, equity, inequality, whatever DEI stands for, as opposed to saying, hey, we've got standards we're going to uphold, and as long as somebody meets that standard, they can do the job?
Well, it gives me no pleasure to go down that road, and I'll tell you why. That particular thought and that particular cause and reason may have some traction, and here's why. First of all, the silence was conspicuous right after this. Normally, an agency, Secret Service, and FBI would come out. It's standard communication procedure, communicating in a crisis. You don't go silent. You tell people what they know, you know right now, and you promise to get back to them. You explain what the effort is and go forth. They've been quiet, and they still are. They haven't come up with a proper communication for the public. Worse, what they've done too is the spokesperson has actually denied things that turned out to be true later and had to be retracted, like dilution of resources and so forth. So having that said, and then also one note, there's many others, apparently Dr. Jill Biden was given 12 Secret Service types to supplement her security at a dinner in Pittsburgh the same day. And yet Trump was given one. And then we see all these critical benchmark security measures, advanced security measures being omitted to the point where it's almost confounding. How could you not think and leave that particular, if it's not a conspiracy theory, a theory on the table that we think could well be an option? I remember teaching an intelligence class for several months to intelligence analysts and other law enforcement types. And when you're dealing with a threat, to do it right, you have to consider any and all options. While we're not doing outlandish things like a spaceship coming from Mars, we're talking about things that, based on history, the kinds of facts that were coming in required any reasonable security person to look into them. Well, the fact that these locked in stone, cast in stone SOPs were ignored or omitted, and then you have silence, and then the explanations you're given are just sophomoric and vacuous.
Yeah,
how could
yeah.
you not think that there might be something to some credence to a possible conspiracy or a possible orchestrated threat? It's just very, very difficult not to go there. If you were not so silent about it and these egregious omissions weren't so blatant, maybe you could tamp that down. But they're going to have a very difficult time now with trying to pull all this back and give some credence to their explanations of why this was done or why that was done. It's just, there's too many things pointing to something else.
Yeah, and then on top of it, the network has just been flooded with conspiracy theories, and that there were multiple shooters, that there are, three shooters, two shooters. Well, there were multiple different kinds of gunfire that day, but it appears that there were really only two people firing: Crooks and the counter sniper team. Now, what's the evidence? Well, a video has come out by, and it was made by former Army. He'd been in the Army during the first Gulf War, but very familiar with ARs. And he was standing outside the event perimeter in front of the AGR building. And he literally was panning, filming these police starting to move around, showing alarm and concern, because apparently they were seeing somebody up on the roof. And then as he's filming, he catches all the shots in terms of, you hear three shots, boom, 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 that take place within 3 seconds. Then there's about a second and a half pause. And then there are five more shots. Boom, 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 boom. Then there's another shot. Boom. Another 5 second delay and a final shot, which apparently was the kill shot. Now, that, you know, that's the evidence right there as far as a total of 10 shots recorded on that video. And you actually can match them up then with the video of Trump. So those first three shots, that's when Trump goes to the ground and is then gets the body bunker from the Secret Service detail. Then that's when the next sort of five shots get sprayed off in rapid succession. Then there's the first shot and then a delay second shot. I'm not sure which of those two shots killed Crooks, but the Secret Service is saying that it was a counter sniper. Now, the only problem I initially had with that was when you look at the photograph of both the site, the location of the body is, his head is pointed up towards the ridge, but he's 5 feet down from the ridge top, which means a counter sniper would not necessarily have been able to see him unless he'd stood up was up on his hands and knees. The other thing was the shot of his head is not clear. They've got him turned on his side, so you can't see this top portion, but it looks like what may have happened. Initially, I said, if he got hit full on in the head with a 300 Win Mag, which is what the counter snipers use, it would have blown up his head. Well, apparently that didn't, that's not what happened, but I guess it peeled back enough of his scalp from back here, and penetrated that just the shock of the bullet alone killed him. And
yes.
So then the question came up, and again, the guy took the film, explained why, because initially the reports were they had three shell casings to the left, five shell casings to the right. And he says, how could that be? Well, the guy got up, he tried to recreate it with his AR, and it was, ARs have a magazine that extends out of the bottom. It comes out of the bottom of the gun like that. So if you put it down on something, it makes it difficult to you can't lower the elevation.
Right.
Well, apparently, to lower the elevation, one thing you can do is you turn the gun on its side so that you've got the magazine now not touching the roof, but it's to the side, and you can still fire. And this guy recreated that, and he discovered that when he did that, those rounds would eject up and to the left.
I understand.
So it tracks with the three shots, because he
makes
said
sense.
What happened was the guy had turned for those initial shots so that he was prone and could get the support of the roof, fired those three shots, and boom, 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 because he was trying to make controlled shots. And then when he saw that he missed and he tried to get up, turn the firearm then in a different direction, which is why you also got a different sound signature. Because if you're down close to the roof with it turned on its side, then you're going to get a different sound off of that roof than you would if the gun is a few feet above it turned upright.
That makes perfect sense.
So I said, okay, perfect sense. Go ahead.
Well, I guess the key on the whole thing is that let's look at this. We had a very poor advance in many of the key protocols, and procedures were not followed.
Right.
Even having said that, had there been some resourceful folks thinking outside the box to compensate for this, they may have been able to mitigate this, maybe respond after the second shot, or the case may be, maybe they would have been able to deter or distract the shooter like that Butler PA police officer allegedly did when he distracted him briefly when he got up on the roof. The shooter pointed to him and he dropped back down. Some believe that may have distracted him enough to maybe not be as accurate. Hard to know. But either way, it just confounds me that folks are not being independent thinkers and adapting with common sense and maybe creative thinking here. But let's assume now that the detail did not receive that information, and maybe folks were not conveying intelligence properly. Maybe. But the idea is that had you had a couple of people in the beginning, like the advanced agent, doing some resourceful, creative things to mitigate and cover for these vulnerabilities, you might have had a better outcome. I just find it extremely difficult to believe that folks in the command post did not relay with the heightened sense of urgency, man on the roof with a gun, hold, whatever the case may be. I guess the way the advance was conducted, they pretty much said, you know, we'll decide what's needed, what's not, we'll come to you, which they didn't. And so obviously the well-intentioned officers, the law enforcement community and the other public safety community in that area were saying, well, we're going to do what we're told. I mean, they are clearly the lead in this, even though they had concerns about how it was being conducted. So I guess just one or two of those normal pre-advance or advance procedures, if they'd been followed, we wouldn't find ourselves in this yeah. horrible situation.
But it's just like you got to have someone in charge. And back in 1985, when the Kelly Laurel was hijacked,
that's right.
There was a response team sent out. So the JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, they deployed Delta Force. And we had at the time something that was called the EST, Emergency Support Team. So the EST was comprised of State Department, both officers and communicators, CIA officers and communicator, FBI, and a representatives of JSOC. And the team was there to support the embassy and in terms of recovering on one of these incidents. Well, the problem was they got on the plane and they hadn't sorted out who was the lead agency, who's in charge. So literally, the State Department and CIA reps got into a fight, a physical altercation on a plane en route to deal with a terrorist situation. And so finally, at a point, the plane landed. It was asked to land at a different location. The CIA guys got off and just said, basically, hey, go screw yourselves, and went off and did their own thing. Okay. Out of that then came this notion of lead agency. And for future terrorist incidents, the State Department was designated as being the lead, the person in charge for coordinating, not the one doing. The doers would be the CIA and the FBI and others. Well, in this particular instance as well, you needed somebody who was in charge, and clearly nobody was, because in the aftermath, the criminal investigation, who's the lead agency? Who's the lead agency for conducting that investigation? Is it Secret Service? Is it FBI? Is it State Police of Pennsylvania? Or is it the local police? I don't know if you know the answer to that offhand.
Critically important. And I've experienced that myself. And so taking all this in, I've been asked about this, and I would offer, what are the steps moving forward? That is the big challenge, because right now we're in a state of horrible, egregious, and very scary vulnerability. I mean, given all the things that have happened, given the answers that Congress is getting by the powers that be that are responsible for this protection, we're in a very, very dangerous state of limbo, actually. But let's move forward and see what we could do. I was asked about this. We had a conference with a Zoom conference, and actually Representative Issa was involved and various people. And the question was asked, well, what do we do moving forward? You know, and we're always clamoring, let's throw money at this, more money. And even the Representative Kennedy from Louisiana was tracking exactly the way I'm tracking. We're so inclined to, okay, they need more money. They need more people. Oh my God, that's going to solve it. Well, that doesn't solve it. The budget for the Secret Service has been increased exponentially in the past year or two. That obviously didn't solve it. What would solve it is going back to basics. We're all inclined to buy the latest and greatest software. And you know how that goes. I mean, this is a metaphor. You buy the latest and greatest. It's incompatible with what you have, and it screws your computer up somewhat. Well, buying the latest and greatest might be okay in terms of if it actually addresses the hemorrhaging. And we have hemorrhaging now. We don't have venous blood bleed loss here. We got hemorrhaging in major arteries, really.
Yeah.
And so the idea would be, my view is, let's go back to basics. What's on paper now? And let's train on that incessantly. The report that Jason Chaff has put out after the 2014 fence jumping incident in September of that year, or earlier, was, gee, what do we do here? Where are the failings? Why are we failing like this? And there were 19 go-to items that were put on the table to say, you need to fix these things. Key among them was more training. He proposed, the committee proposed 25%. That would looked at that, and that's a pretty significant number. Although, given what happens, it seems like we need that much. But at any rate, I think they arrived at something like 12. Well, the data that I have, and you can look this up on the internet, basically shows that they had much, much less than that. I mean, as low as 2.7% by my research. Well, training is huge. So if you're going to put together a team, you want cohesiveness. You want people to be trained to the same sheet of music. You want them to develop instincts as best as possible, much like a sports team does. A successful sports team trains way more than we do, candidly, and they learn each other's strengths and weaknesses, and they can almost sense how things should go. Well, that obviously wasn't the case. They were grappling, what do we do, what do we do? Well, when you have a zero fail game and you're protecting people, that doesn't wash. So you need go back to the basics. Attacking the principal exercises, create teams that can work together as much as possible prior to launching, prior to deploying. They used to do that. I don't see that here. And certainly don't dilute and send disparate resources with disparate kinds of training and experience to something so critical. You shouldn't do it anyway. But if you're doing it for something as critical as a major declared presidential candidate, whom has an inordinate thousands of death threats ongoing. To me, it would be a great place to start to get these folks and get leadership primarily to buy into this and say, look, we're going to make sure we make it a priority to protect these important candidates. I'll give them a little bit of relief, a little bit of a caveat, and that is apparently, as of Butler, I believe there were between 30 and 35 details that the Secret Service were detailed to man. Well, certainly that dilutes the manpower, dilutes the energy, dilutes the resources. But if that's the case, leadership should have stepped in. For example, the director, whom was placed there on good authority, it's published by Jill Biden. Naturally, she's got a bias. Let's just be honest. There were disparate resources sent out, and many were denied to Trump and were given to other details. So however that operates in the equation, but the bottom line is you should be giving them everything they need. But when you look at that, I go back to basics. Do the basics and make sure everyone is very, very proficient at the basics. Do all the things that are tried and true, and then we can talk about Star Wars-esque technology and fancy stuff. And that's absent. I mean, look at the response again when you get a chance for your audience, and you'll see that was ad hoc. That was like a delayed, reactive, what do I do, deer in the headlight response.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of the female agents in particular were just like, you know, they didn't know what to do with their gun. You know, and that goes back. It's not just training. It's the training standard.
Yes.
You know, so if you have a low standard on the training, I don't care how much training you do. If you don't learn to do it right, and you're not held accountable to that standard, then you wind up with people who can't shoot. I mean, I'll just give you an example. As a pistol instructor in the NRA, to become an NRA pistol instructor, you have to be able to demonstrate that you can shoot a 6-inch grouping of shots at 15 yards, 45 feet, and get 16 of 20 in a 6-inch groupie. Now, it's not impossible, but unless you practice it and develop the skill, not everybody can do it. And it used to be in the NRA that they'd allow people to be pistol instructors who couldn't shoot that groupie. And so they got a new guy in the training division, and he came and said, "Oh, we're going to have the standard. This is the standard. And you either make it or you don't." And when I went through the process to become a training counselor, there were 12 other people in the class, and two of them were black females. And if you're going to be DEI, you're going to say, "Well, we're going to give the black females an advantage." Now, both ladies were outstanding in all other aspects, but when it came to shooting, only one of them met the standard, and the other one, she shot 15 of 20 instead of 16 of 20. And what they did, they said, "Sorry, come back next time. Work on the shooting."
Exactly.
And so just because she was, because she was black, because she was extremely articulate, extremely competent, and the all other T, she had everything else nailed, but she didn't make that standard, and they didn't let her through the door.
Well,
And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
you're absolutely right. And there are agents, whistleblowers that have, before Butler, filed complaints through Grassley and other means, complaining that that exact thing happened under the leadership of Director Cheadle. Apparently, the standards were diluted, and they were diluted to the point where many folks that could not even meet basic minimum standards, less than that, much less, they were passed through and given the passing grade somehow. And there's evidence for that. That's probably going to come out as well. There's a congressman that basically summarized it. He's a sharpshooter and talked a lot about things that you're talking about, Larry. And his summary was, for the general consumption, DEI means DIE. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I don't care who you are, what you look like. I want to see competence. I want to see competence under pressure. I want to see commitment and figuring things out, even when there's, limited resources. I mean, my previous, I mentioned this prior in other forums, that the boss we had was literally a very, very stringent, no nonsense, no sense of humor person. Well, that's what you want. And he basically would say, "We have a zero fail situation, and I don't want anything less. And I want you to work as hard as you possibly can." So we'd work hours, hours into the night, figuring things out, physically looking at holes and vulnerabilities that may not have been noted earlier. That kind of work ethic in this arena is critically important. And candidly, I don't see that. So these are the kinds of things that, for whatever reason, we don't teach, we don't foster, and aren't practiced.
Well, I think you've identified what is the major problem out of this, or let's call it the major revelation of this failed assassination attempt, is a complete breakdown in Secret Service leadership and implementation of standard operating procedures.
I think that summarizes it best.
We stay away from all the conspiracy theory. I think the evidence will show it was a single shooter. Now, whether what ex the extent of other support that he had,
Hard to know now.
yeah, there's a lot that smells about this, but President Trump, former President Trump, clearly had been set up for failure. That.
And it's interesting you say that, because this is not just a one-off. This is an ongoing pattern that whistleblowers have come forth, and the service had tried to hide through the spokesperson, through these last two top leadership people. I mean, if you didn't give them the right resources, why? Well, they tried to cover. So we gave them what we thought they needed. Well, you talk to folks that are on the detail, that are doing the advances, saying, "We need this. Please give us this." "Well, we really don't have it. Make it work." Well, they weren't even going to give them a CS team until 24 hours before now. I mean, to me, that is just unfathomable. So, looking at all this together, how could you not think that there's something else? But at any rate, I would offer, go back to the basics and give honest, proper attention to these things. I don't care if it's a Green candidate, Robert Kennedy. They all deserve, under the Constitution, under the law, they deserve their proper, component of protection. to desperately apply it. What are you thinking? That's criminal, candidly. That's not fair, period.
Yeah. Well, we were coming up on a little over an hour, and I don't want to take up any more of your time, but this, I'm going to, we'll do this again probably next week as things develop and we learn more. But I think you have clearly identified where the shortcomings are and how to fix this. That's where we need to go. So,
and that's the thing. And I appreciate the audience, appreciate the opportunity, Larry. And I hope we can move forward with better luck and better training and a better attitude.
Right. All right. Hey, listen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. And thanks for listening. Please subscribe and support to sonar21.com. Thanks.
Thank you.